This is Treasury Matters, the podcast from Alma. Each week through this series, we will be joined by a leading industry voice to talk all things Treasury. Joining us for this episode is Ruth Doubleday of the Building Societies Association to talk about how mutuals differ from high street banks.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks again for listening into this podcast. This is another edition of Treasury Matters from ALMA, the UK Asset and Liability Management Association. I'm your host this afternoon. My name is Justin Fox. I'm Group Treasurer of Virgin Money, and I'm delighted to have Ruth Doubleday from the Building Societies Association with me this afternoon to talk about how building societies, I guess, are different from banks. So, Ruth, welcome. Would you like to introduce yourself to everybody listening in today?
Yes, and thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be here. So I'm Ruth Doubleday. I'm Head of Prudential Regulation at the BSA. That means I cover almost everything that comes out of the PRA, CPs, and a bunch of other stuff as well. So audit reform, big topic at the moment, FSCS, tax. So yeah, very happy to be here and to talk to you today.
Can I start off, first question, what is a building society and how do they differ from banks?
It's a good question because not everybody appreciates the differences. I know a lot of people do, but not as many people as you'd expect. So a building society is owned by its members. So if you have a savings account or a mortgage or any other product at a building society, you're probably a member, which means you own part of the society. You can vote at the AGM. You can stand to be on the board. So there are no external shareholders, which is important. So the whole way that the building society is run is for its members. So it doesn't have to pay dividends to shareholders.
And what sort of role does the Building Societies Association play in supporting the building societies here in the UK? And then specifically, you know, are there aspects that relate to what Treasury teams also focus on and therefore your role at the BSA?
Yes, we do a wide range of activities to support our members. We work with government. The new Labour government has committed to doubling the size of the mutual sector. We're not sure what that means yet, so it's for people like the BSA to tell them what it might mean. And in terms of my role, you know, the PRA will do consultations on new regulations. We coordinate and respond to all consultations that affect the sector. And that's really important, particularly for smaller societies, because, you know, they might not have a big team of people who can review consultation documents and respond. So we'll respond on their behalf, but getting input from our members.
It's an important thing for, I think, for people to bear in mind. There is a vast range of size between building societies. I mean, clearly, I'm now intricately linked with Nationwide, but you have a lot smaller societies who are probably more locally focused. Is that the right way to think about the structure of the mutual sector in the UK?
Yes, that's right. There's 42 building societies. Nationwide, in terms of assets, accounts for about 3/4 of the sector. So it's a very diverse group in terms of size. Some of the smallest ones, they might have one branch, very locally focused, but run just as professionally. You know, they have to comply with very similar regulations to the big ones. We also have credit unions. We have 7 credit unions that are members of the BSA, which is interesting too.
Clearly, because there are no shareholders, it's member-owned businesses, I guess there must be some quite strict legislation around what building societies can and cannot do. And therefore, if there's legislation, that means that there will be regulation supporting that legislation, just as banks have, for example, in ring fencing. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So there's the Building Societies Act. It was just updated earlier this year, actually, just ahead of the general election. It got through on wash-up, which we're happy about. It took about 10 years to get some of those updates, largely to bring it into line with the legislation that applies to banks through the Companies Act. So there are restrictions really to protect the core purpose of a building society. So most of your business needs to be mortgage lending, accepting deposits from customers. So there's nature limits in place to make sure that they are quite restricted on what they can do. Actually, the same regulations that apply to banks apply to building societies. So when it comes to capital requirements, liquidity requirements, it's the same rules. But there's also some additional pieces like the building society source book, the much loved source book that places various restrictions on a building society to help them to manage their risks.
If I remember rightly, the Building Societies Act was a model for the ring fencing legislation in terms of what they wanted ring fencing banks to be able to do, because that was quite restrictive and very much about preserving safety and soundness for members. But clearly, if I recollect, the Building Societies Act's probably about, 40 years old now. Whilst there have been changes, the business model for financial services continues to evolve. And I suppose there's this constant need to keep regulation refreshed. So do you think that the source book is something that would benefit from a sort of a degree of updating?
Yes, absolutely. So the source book dates back to the 1990s, a couple of regulators ago, actually, the Building Societies Commission.
Oh my gosh, yes, that's going back in the past.
The source book has been updated a few times since then, but it introduced these concepts of different approaches. So you've got the administered approach, the matched approach, the extended approach, the comprehensive approach. And those include various limits to help you manage your business. But those were calibrated quite a long time ago. And just to take an example here, to manage your interest rate risk in the banking book, one way you can eliminate interest rate risk entirely is by not doing any fixed rate products. And when some of these limits were introduced, there were very few. You know, you might have a small amount of your balance sheet on fixed rate mortgage products. Whereas nowadays, 95% of mortgages or new mortgages are fixed rate. So it becomes much harder to manage within the fixed rate lending limit, just as one example. So those limits really do need to be refreshed to match the market as it is today, or perhaps maybe a more fundamental rethink as to how the source book runs. Because, and I always say, risk management is a more nuanced discipline than setting limits and then filling your boots.
Setting limits is sort of a crude way of managing risk. And I guess clearly the market has evolved, but also management teams, boards, systems, capabilities, they've all evolved too. And therefore it would make logical sense for primary regulation to be updated as well.
And the other thing to say about the source book is it predates things like the senior managers regime. So you now have the senior managers regime. If you're an FD and you're SMF2 and you're responsible for managing interest rate risk in the banking book, and you have to demonstrate reasonable steps that you've managed your risks. So you shouldn't need someone to tell you what your limits should be. You should be able to set your own limits, justify them, have the board sign them off. It feels more appropriate these days to have something a bit more principles based.
But there are other aspects of regulation that you spent some time talking about. And one of the things when we've met up in the past, you've talked a lot about proportionality. And clearly, strong and simple has also been a topic for regulators. Why is that important when you think about it in terms of what your members are looking at?
Yes, you can read a lot of regulations that use the word proportionality in them. Sometimes exactly the same regulations will apply to large banks and small building societies, and they say apply this proportionately. But nobody has any idea what that actually means. How do you apply a regulation that's exactly the same in a proportionate way? It's very challenging. I think that to be truly proportionate, regulation needs to be different in some way. It needs to have a different calibration, be simpler to implement, to make sure it's appropriate for the firms to which it applies. And I would also say that there's a bit of a myth out there that I'd like to bust, that if you're a small firm, really, the gold standard is to apply the regulations that apply to larger firms. And I think that's a bit of a myth, because it's not just a case of we can't do it because we can't afford it. It might just not be appropriate. It might be calibrated differently. So the Basel framework's a good example here. So the Basel framework is calibrated to internationally active banks. And then within the EU, it's applied to all banks and all deposit takers. But you don't actually need to do that to comply with the Basel framework. So that's why the PRA, now we've left the EU, the PRA is looking to develop a more proportionate regime for smaller deposit takers under the banner of strong and simple.
I get the point there, right? And we've talked about this quite a bit in the past. But the challenge then is for institutions, let's say boards or FDs, to try and determine what that should look like. Maybe they go for external advice. And there seems to be, well, the safest approach is to take a sort of more comprehensive approach. And therefore, how do boards find their way, or how does a treasury function within a mid-sized building society find their way through these, given the extensiveness of what regulation requires?
Great question. And I wish I knew the answer. If the regulations are exactly the same, you know, you kind of have to do it all, really. And under the Basel framework, you had to do Pillar 3 disclosures, whether you're a large firm or a small firm. That's one of the things that's gone away under the new strong and simple approach. So you no longer have to do Pillar 3. There was good evidence that nobody was really looking at Pillar 3 disclosures. There's a couple of people out there that look at Pillar 3 disclosures, people who are applying for a job in your prudential team, some academics and competitors. So people read each other's Pillar 3 disclosures. But that was never the purpose of Pillar 3 disclosures. It was supposed to be for investors to apply market discipline. So to answer your question, yes, it's really difficult. And being in a small firm where you have a ton of regulations that apply, you can't really pick and choose. You kind of have to comply with all of them.
Which is difficult, because that point about investors in Pillar 3 is a good one, because I would think that if you're a smaller firm and you're not raising external debt, right? Not all building societies do this because they're self-funded through the deposits. What benefit do you get from having to pull that together? Because it's time and money. And I suppose sometimes for a board, you need to think about, what should I be spending time on? Because it's not just the prudential regulation. There's all manner of regulation, be it cyber, other aspects of compliance, KYC, AML, and I suppose proportionality needs to look across the whole regulatory landscape. Is that a fair comment?
That's right. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And actually, there was updates to FSMA, the Financial Services and Markets Act, that went through last year. And within that, it now requires the PRA and the FCA to regularly review their rule books. So looking at old rules and seeing if they're still appropriate. I think that's a good discipline. I've suggested that the regulators should almost have a one in, one out rule. I don't mean that you just have to ditch one rule to bring another one in. I mean, when you're developing a new rule, they should start with the existing rule book and see what they've got that's a little bit similar. And rather than just bolt on new pieces that are duplicative, adjust what they've got.
That would make sense. And I suppose since some of these things then culminate in annual exercises like an ILAP and an ICAP, you could almost say for a business that is reasonably consistent in what it does, and building societies tend to be immensely well capitalized, right, with very strong capital ratios and very good liquidity profiles, simply because they started off as deposit taking institutions, is there merit in doing an annual exercise such as that? Because they're quite involved processes, and I would assume in smaller societies, a lot of that responsibility sits with an FD and a very small team to pull those together. So a proportionate approach may be to say, well, look, do we need to refresh this every year? Because if it's basically saying the same thing, is there merit?
That's right. And under the new consultation that's out at the moment, there is a proposal to reduce the frequency of ICAP and ILAP to once every 2 years instead of every year, which is welcome. However, you still have to do some of the underlying calculations for Pillar 2A and stress testing annually. Well, that's a very large part of the process. So in our response to the consultation, you know, we might be saying, well, why do you still have to do this annually. It could be different for different types of firm. If you're a startup bank, your business model might have changed entirely in a year versus a 150-year-old building society that's lending mortgages and taking deposits. And at the moment, they're doing it annually, but it probably doesn't change that much from one year to the next.
No, and you're absolutely right, because if you're having to do, let's say, those interest rate risk sensitivities under Pillar 2A, that's an involved piece of work. The only time saving you would get is you just haven't documented it. Or there may be an expectation that whilst you don't submit it to the regulator, your board is sort of reviewing it on an annual basis. So you're pretty much doing most of the work anyway.
That's right. And I also think about this in terms of, if your board is spending a lot of time reviewing these documents, what is it that the board's not doing that it should be doing? So,
yes.
You know, are they missing a conversation around strategy when there's changes in the market, interest rates are changing? If you think back a year ago when we had the Liz Truss thing with the interest rates, and if a board is speaking about their ICAP, is that really the right thing that they should be doing?
Yes, because you have a small group of people that are able to sort of contribute towards that. So they've got to be across all those issues. So that's why I say it's things like compliance and regulation. Consumer duty would have been a big issue for smaller firms, presumably, to engage on, and an important one. And so that balanced approach is, what are the priorities for a smaller firm?
Consumer duty is interesting because in the conduct space, the concept of proportionality is a little bit different, because you can't really do large firms versus small firms, because if you're a customer, you deserve the same level of protection if you bought your product from a small firm or a large firm. But maybe it could be more risk-based by product. So the amount of work you have to do under the consumer duty to be sure that you've fair value on a deposit savings account versus a CFD or a complicated insurance product. You know, maybe there could be some proportionality in there for the FCA as well.
Now, if we could go back to the source book itself, you talked about different approaches based on presumably the size, scale, and complexity of a society. That relates to the treasury activities and the way they risk manage. Is that correct? Can you say a little bit more about what that means in practice?
Yes, it generally goes according to size. In theory, it doesn't, because any society can apply to go on whichever approach they want to go on. But I used fixed rate products as an example earlier. The lowest approach, if you like, is called administered approach. And there you wouldn't do any fixed rate products on either side of the balance sheet, or it's very limited.
So you take no interest rate risk at all?
Not quite none. I think you can take, that's like 10%. Or.
So it's a small amount. So it's a reasonably straightforward business.
Yeah. And your fixed rate lending could only be up to 2 years. Then if you moved up to the matched approach, you can do a bit more. You can do up to 50% liabilities and 50% administered rate lending. And then you go to extended and you get a bit more. The other thing to remember, these are only guidelines. However, building societies are very well behaved. They tend to treat the guidelines as if they're rules, because you will get a lot of questioning if you're outside. You can apply to have an extension, but they tend to be well behaved and stay within these until they've got the nod from the PRA.
The government, the new government, they've talked a lot about wanting to grow the role of mutuals. And I remember, if I go back to the global financial crisis, the mutual model raised its profile at that particular point in time, because as a source of stable capital and not driven by sort of shareholder motivations. What are the areas that you think that mutuals can play a greater role in to support the government's objectives? And what are you, if you can say, what are you talking to the government about the role of mutuals in the UK?
It's early days, and part of it is just making sure we have a seat at the table, making sure that whenever the government has a task force on whatever it might be, having mutual voices around the table so that those voices are heard. Having diversity of business models is good for financial stability. I mean, you alluded to this, that during the global financial crisis, it was when the large banks were withdrawing from the market or reducing mortgage lending, building societies were there so that people could continue to get mortgages. So that diversity of business models has got to be good for continuing to lend money to the economy. I mean, some of the other interesting things. So there's lots of talk around Thames Water, for example. You know, should Thames Water be nationalised? You know, this is a good example where the PLC model hasn't worked too well. Those shareholders haven't actually, that's not proved to be a great outcome for Thames Water. Should Thames Water be mutualised? There are structures that you could make that work. The government would need to put some money in as debt. But over time, if you had a company providing water to its customers, would you get the same outcomes you've got currently in terms of water quality if the people that are drinking the water and swimming in the water are also the ones that are running the or
owning the company, right? So basically your customers are your owners in that sort of sense. And therefore, have you got a better alignment around strategic interests? That's an interesting idea.
Well, you've got complete alignment between customers and owners because they're the same people.
And I suppose, you know, I mean, clearly I've been through a large part of it this year through, you know, Nationwide acquiring Virgin Money. And clearly we have another example of Coventry having bought the Co-op Bank. The mutual model seems to go from strength to strength. There was that period, I guess, back in the late 90s where mutuals were becoming PLCs. That didn't work out so well. But the mutual model seems to be one of strength. What makes that possible?
I think mutuals can take a much longer term view because they're not having to focus on the next dividend payment. They can really plan for the future in a way that a PLC perhaps is a bit more short-termist, depending on who the shareholders are.
On Strong and Simple, one of the things the regulators talk about is the complexity problem. What does that mean?
Great question. So I think there's one school of thought that it's a complex world and you need complex rules for a complex world. I don't personally subscribe to that. It makes it harder to understand, harder to comply with. I think simple rules are better, stronger. And what I'd like to remind people of here is when it comes to the Basel capital ratio, it all comes back to 8%. So you have to hold 8% of capital over your risk-weighted assets and then buffers on top. Now, the 8%, there's no science behind the 8%.
No, I'm just going to think it's sort of like an anachronism from the past, right?
Yes, and it works. So, you know, the market understands that that's about the right amount of capital to be held. Yeah. But you can get sucked into a very detailed conversation about a risk weight and how accurate it is. But it still boils back to the 8%, which is a judgment. So layering on more and more complexity doesn't necessarily achieve the right outcome. And then buffers is a good example. So in Basel III, they introduce buffers. So you have your 8% and then you hold a buffer on top of that. The concept being you can draw down on the buffer in a crisis and then build it back up again. But actually, most firms do not want to operate within their buffers. They hold a management buffer on top of the buffer and they don't like to go into the buffers because it means increased supervisory focus and nobody wants increased supervisory focus.
I can tell you from my own experience of working at different size firms, that's absolutely true. It is something that I sometimes think regulators, until they sit within an institution, don't really understand. So there, we had the Bufferati speech, I think, from Vicky Supporter a few years back, because no one wants to be the first to sort of test the appetite. Certainly, you don't want to be there where you've got increased oversight, clearly from the regulator, but questions being asked by your own board and what it would take to restore back to that. So you have buffers on buffers simply because no one wants to test that theory. And then clearly the only way you could possibly test it is in an extreme scenario, which is fast unfolding, is difficult to manage. Like we saw, I guess, in spring 23, right, with the US regional banks.
Yeah. So you end up with this situation where you've got buffers on buffers and all capital is a buffer. So the 8% is a buffer. You're not allowed to breach the 8%. That's a hard limit. But it's not an automatic, so there isn't an automatic link between breaching threshold conditions and the PRA deciding to call it a day and shut you down and the breach of the 8%. So that's a good example of the complexity problem. Also, if people are spending a lot of time just trying to understand the rules because they're just not written very clearly, that's time they could be doing something else.
Yes, I remember with the EBA Q&A, you have an incredibly long list of people asking questions around interpreting what they meant and getting into the detail. And I think that point is well taken around what else could they be doing with their time, be it maybe focus on better customer outcomes, controls over perhaps more complex and opaque risks like cyber.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that simpler rules are better, as long as they capture all the risks. But so you can really focus on what really matters and what the key risks are, rather than sort of some slightly more obscure things, which might be more relevant for a large or a niche player, but perhaps less relevant for a smaller firm.
A smaller firm that has a very low risk model, right, which is bringing in deposits and using that to lend out on residential mortgages, and also which is structured within a statutory framework, the law around what proportion of your funding needs to come from deposits, what proportion of your lending needs to be on residential mortgages.
Yeah, regulatory reporting is another favourite topic, where some would say, oh, it's naturally proportionate because these reg returns, they don't really apply to you, but you've still got to do them. So you've still got to go through and decide where to put zeros. So a return might be mostly zeros, but if you're the SMF2, the FD, you've still got to satisfy yourself that that's right. So you've got to go through the process, you've got to sign it off to submit documents includes a load of zeros. So that time, even if it might not feel like it's very complicated, but it's not a very value-adding activity.
But overall, you think the outlook for mutuals and building societies in particular is upward trajectory. Do you expect to see more consolidation within some of the societies?
Well, we've just seen some major consolidation, Nationwide and Virgin, Coventry and Co-op. Don't know. Good question. Yeah. If there's more to come or not. I wouldn't say that there's sort of distressed firms that need rescuing. I would say the sector is in a very healthy place at the moment, particularly we've just had a cost of living crisis, but actually their balance sheets are very robust. Arrears levels are low. You could ask the question, have they taken enough risk? Because it's become increasingly difficult for a first-time buyer to get a mortgage. It's something our members are very focused on. So, yeah, it's a good question around consolidation. Who knows? It's always a possibility.
Another question that occurs to me, and I've seen this as part of the SCIOC review response, was ring fencing legislation helpful to the mutual sector, or did it create more challenges? And again, I'm thinking that sort of focus around residential property, deposit competition. I know that the BSA responded to the SCIOC review, but has that been a challenge?
Slightly before my time. I'm not sure I've got a view on this one. Building societies are outside of scope of ring fence in any case because of the Building Societies Act. You know, they're already limited in what they can do.
Well, I seem to remember part of the response to the SCIOC review was a concern that because ring fence banks had excess liquidity, that they drove competition and pricing within the retail mortgage market. It's not that builders are driven by profitability, but it made margins more competitive. And that, given that building societies grow organic capital, effectively, I always think of capital within building societies as inherited capital, because you become a member, you benefit from 150 years worth of accumulated profit retention. So my question is really around, has ring fencing created challenges for building societies? Maybe if you think about the mortgage market being incredibly competitive, they've had to look at alternative parts of the mortgage market to be able to balance off the cost of deposits.
Yeah, and building societies will look at some sort of slightly niche products, not because it's riskier, and actually the data shows that it's less risky, but it's just a bit more manual processes in the underwriting, slightly more complicated.
What I call story mortgages. because there's always a story behind them, and it's not something that you can basically put through an algorithm or that sort of speed of turnaround that larger institutions have sort of focused on.
Yeah, and that's one of the ways that they sort of carve themselves out so that they can make the margin that they need to make. You're asking earlier about sort of mutuals generally, and I do wonder in the mortgage market, if we didn't have building societies and if you could only get your mortgage from a PLC bank, what kind of price you'd pay for your mortgage and whether it would be as competitive as it is currently.
Yes, because building societies are able to operate at slightly thinner margins than PLCs, because PLCs need to offer a return to their shareholders. Building societies, I guess, would argue that they offer that pricing benefit in terms of more competitive savings rates and more competitive mortgage rates, and that's how they benefit their members. I suppose that's the logic, right?
They might not have the economies of scale that some of the larger players, but I think it drives down the prices that the large banks are offering on mortgages as well.
That's a very good point. One final question for me is really on sustainability. I suppose the transition to a more sustainable model, and I'm not necessarily talking just about climate change here, must be very in keeping with the building society ethos because of their ownership structure. Can you say a little bit about the role of sustainability within mutuals?
Absolutely. Many of our members have products to help people to retrofit their houses, to bring up the EPC rating, to put double glazing, solar panels, whatever they need to do. This is going to be a massive project over the coming years, because the housing stock is a source of emissions, and the building societies are well placed to lend people money to do that. It's not just about lending money as well. It's also about the advice. It's a very confusing thing to do. I looked at this myself recently, and what I live in a Victorian property. What do I need to do to retrofit my house? It's not a straightforward question. The order in which you do different pieces of work, it's a complicated business, which I think is part of the reason why people have been a bit slow to do it. But I think that's a growth area for sure in the future, and it will need doing.
Ruth, thank you for your time this afternoon. I've enjoyed having this chat, and I look forward to seeing you at future ALMA events, because I know you're a strong advocate for the mutual sector here in the UK.
Thanks, Justin. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Treasury Matters. We hope you enjoyed it. Look out for more episodes coming from us soon, and in the meantime, why don't you follow us on your favourite podcast app?